No matter how far along you are in your entrepreneurial journey, there are moments when you may feel isolated, stressed, or grapple with imposter syndrome. Just know that you're not alone, and perspectives from other founders that have overcome the same challenges can make all the difference. Comcast NBC Universal's Lyft Labs offers you that perspective by giving a platform to Black and Latino founders navigating the startup world and life's everyday challenges in season 2 of Founding in Color. This 3-part docuseries lets you hear directly from other underrepresented founders. As local sports network founder Dustin McMahon puts it, "Every time our company reaches a new milestone, I get further and further away from people who look like me." Each episode of Founding in Color offers up gems from startup founders like PopViewer's Chris Witherspoon and Felocity Okumukun of Unscripted TV that will make you think and inspire you to action. Whether your business is still an idea or you're pitching to a VC for funding to scale to the next level, this is a series to watch. You can now catch all 3 episodes of Founding in Color on Peacock. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the next episode of the Everything Matters podcast. My name is Bradford Speaks. I'm your host, also the founder and CEO of BeLegendary.coach, where we transform leaders into legends. My very special guest today is a gentleman by the name of Marcus Jimenez. Marcus is a CEO and founder of a company called Briefly. Briefly is a cloud-based insights reporting platform that helps businesses transform mundane data into actionable insight briefs for teams. Marcus has been in the space of creative design for more than 20 years, and it's probably safe to say that Marcus is what I call an OG in the creator space. He was a creator long before this idea of being a creator for a career even came into existence. In fact, he cut his teeth as a creator, painting on the walls and train tunnels of Brooklyn, New York. He had a mentor pick him up in high school and saw his raw talent and began to groom and develop him to go down the path to chase the career that he's running today. What also makes this episode so special is that we're celebrating Black History Month in the month of February. Not that Black history can be relegated to one month. Black history should be celebrated throughout the year. That being said, Marcus is one of several CEOs and founders who are featured in the new docuseries on the Peacock Network called Founding in Color. This docuseries highlights some of the challenges, the successes, and things that founders of color bump up against in trying to get their companies off the ground and their visions seen by the world. If you haven't had the opportunity to check out this truly inspiring docuseries on the Peacock Network, I encourage you to please go and check that out now. You'll hear stories shared that are moving and will give you insight into some of the challenges and struggles that founders of color face in the world of business. Marcus is a true trailblazer and a thought leader in the space of creative design. Please help me welcome Marcus Jimenez, a super cool brother, to the Everything Matters podcast. Marcus, welcome to the Everything Matters podcast, my man. Let's get it popping. Marcus Jimenez, man, it's Bradford Speaks. And Marcus, we're on the Everything Matters podcast. Marcus, thank you so much for being with me on the podcast today, man. I know you're such a busy guy and got so much going on. I know you're home with your little guy today as well, who's not feeling too hot. So I appreciate you for making the space, man, for us to have this conversation, a very meaningful conversation. And I'm really thrilled to get it out to the audience. So thanks for being here, man.
Nah, it's a pleasure to be with you. And you know, thank you for just creating the podcast itself. I do think, you know, and listening to a couple of episodes, I think, you know, things do matter. And I think getting to the core of some of these conversations, which is a fantastic topic, right, come out with Founding in Color, I think we'll be able to dive into a lot of those things. But I appreciate you and I appreciate the time and the space to be able to tell our story.
My pleasure, man. My pleasure. Yeah, I'm excited about the Founding in Color. When I found out about that project, I was like, dude, how can I be a part of this? And it just sort of turned out to be one of the network podcasts. So I'm awesome. So Marcus, I just want to kind of give a brief overview of a little bit about you and your professional career, some of the things you've been involved in, what you've done. You got some formal education, your bachelor's of fine arts degree from the Fashion Institute of Technology. And you were sharing with me off camera that you're starting to pick up some custom shoemaking, and that's in your DNA. And we might get a chance to talk about that. But you've also been involved in a lot of things in the marketing, digital marketing space. You know, you've been nationally recognized by the American Marketers Association, the Art Directors Club, and the Society of Publication Designers. In 2007, you were also honored by the Ad Color Industry Coalition as the Change Agent Award recipient for your dedication to the industry diversity and community, which is perfect. It's a perfect kind of a backdrop for the conversation we're having around Founding in Color. You also served as a board of directors for that organization until 2017, while also co-founding the Ad Color Diversity and Inclusion Conference, the industry's largest gathering of ethnic advertising, marketing, creative, and technology professionals. Man, what a brilliant resume you put together for yourself, Marcus. And you look like a pretty young guy so far, man. So I don't know how you got all this done. It's like 10 years. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I'm trying, man. I just try to stay busy, man. You know,
yeah.
But it was getting here was not I didn't take the straightest route. Mm. I think, being a Latino founder and of a startup in the B2B SaaS space, you would not have imagined that that would have been the path that I did. But some way, somehow, the universe puts you where you need to be. And
there it is.
And sure enough, I got here. But yeah, indeed, it's been an incredible journey. And my founder's journey of getting here is one part. I think it's part of, of what is, slowly becoming a trilogy, I think, in my lifetime, in my life's work. I started out, I was born and raised Puerto Rican from out of New York. And I was born in what is now, back then it was Bushwick and Williamsburg. Now it's all East Williamsburg or whatever, Solomon, whatever the hell you want to call it. But back then I lived right behind the lumber yard over by, it was a big ass lumber yard over by, Macho's in Bushwick.
Right.
And I still have family that still lives over in Tenney Projects over on block 4, block 3. And, so I, that whole area and that era of growing up, was instilled a lot of grit, instilled a lot of, born into that adversity. I was a creative kid ever since, when I was a child, everything from, chalk writing on the street, outside the house to, eventually getting into graffiti writing, which got me into a hell of a lot of trouble, but it spawned creativity in me. The irony was that, when I got into graffiti, actually, what I realized later was that teachers saw that I was always writing, and it was actually a calligraphy teacher, Mr. Ray, who actually picked me out of the group. He kept seeing me doodle in my notebooks, and he was like, "You've got some talent," and plucked me out. It was like, "You need to join my calligraphy class." And wow. I started writing calligraphy, and that put me on a path towards artwork. And that eventually led me to music and art. I went to music and art high school Fame. So literally like the movie, yes, my friends reenacted those scenes of Fame outside, wherever we were on lunch or outside of the school.
Yeah.
I made my way into, and it was an African-American illustrator, my homeroom teacher, Dr. Bing, that saved me from dropping out of high school, back then.
Yeah.
And I've always had these angels, along my way. I've always been able to kind of put me on the right direction. And they've always been people of color. I've always had that luck. I've always had that. And so eventually that led me to FIT. FIT, I got plucked out to start an internship at a Hispanic agency. And we touched a little bit of this on Founding in Color. There were three Cubans that started up, Vidal, Reynales, and Moya. And Manny Vidal was one of the partners, and I took to him. He was like a mentor of mine, and he planted the seed in my head. Don't ever work to live. Don't ever work to live. Work to own. That was the seed that started me on the path. And after that, my trajectory just started growing from there. So I did the agency lifestyle, advertising and marketing out of New York. Mm-hmm. Did that. So I did the Madison Avenue thing for a number of years. Had a small studio right around 9/11 when that. When 9/11 came down, it was a horrific event for New York. Yeah. Right when we were starting to come out around 2003, I got recruited to head out to Denver, Colorado to start up a Hispanic arm of an agency that was owned by Omnicom at the time. And I headed out west, and people thought I was crazy. Manny even thought was like, "Yo, you're out of your mind. Rhea's just going to like, you are the graveyard. Now you want to Denver? Like, why are you doing that?" Everybody was like, "What are you doing?"
Right.
And I, the opportunity I realized now in hindsight, hindsight is always 20/20, but I always had that keen sense of, I always enjoyed white space, doing the thing that nobody knew, thought that they could do, and where innovation lives. And I always took to that. I always felt like I was always the kid that if you told them you can't do it, trust me, I'm going to show you that it can be done. Right.
Right. Right.
And I come from that. I'm cut from that cloth. I was born different. And so, that being born in that adversity gives you that kind of grit, and it gives you that hustle. And I had that New York vibe in me. I got that in my blood. And I was like, you know what? Yeah, All right, you don't think I could do that? All right, well, let's go do that.
Right.
And then sure enough, yeah, man. And then, you know, and I was bothered about it. You know, I was like, all right, cool. Everybody thinks that my career is going to falter. And let's see what happens. When I went out there, you know, it was a small pilot project that Coors had given the agency at the time. $1 million initiative was like, hey, look, you know, don't screw this up, but we want you guys to handle all the Hispanic promotional marketing efforts, you know, for Coors Light. And did that for about 5-6 years. We grew Coors Light into number one brand across 7 different markets. At the time, we had built an entire discipline that Omnicom never even had, right? Promotional retail marketing for the Hispanic market. Mm-hmm. And drove that business. And after, you know, did my time, 5 years in, you know, I cashed in my chips and I was like, I'm out, you know, I'm done with the agency life. It was time for me to start doing it for my own. I, you know, imagine the scale of what we were doing and the amount of money and wealth that we were driving, right? For a brand. Yeah. I was like, you know what? If I could take 1/10 of that and just do that for me and my people, then all of a sudden, you know what I mean? At least I can say no to projects. At least I can choose the people that I want to be able to work with. And, started a consultancy and my wife was like, you need to just be done. Here's like, you know, $1,000 and just, you know, she had just finished her JD. So we were switching, you know, I covered her while she was like studying for the bar and getting everything set. Right. And then I was like, all right, she was like, you know what? Take some time off. Don't take a job. Like just relax and chill. Like I got us, I'll hold this down and, you know, just take some time off. Like at that point, I had been working since I was 12 years old, 13. Under the table, working at, you know, on Graham Avenue, you know what I mean? Like working out in stores, working retail. And by the time I had left the agency, I had worked, I was 33. I had worked for literally 20 years and I had never taken more than 2 months off. Like even during that time, when I was 13, 14 years old, I had summer jobs. I had after school jobs. I almost dropped out of high school because we needed money. And coming up that way, you know, having that hustle in me and that grind in me, I lasted 4.5 weeks, 5 weeks. And then I was like, I got to do something. And sure enough, I started a consultancy and took off, started working with PepsiCo, started working with a number of different brands. That's where the seed for, you know, briefly came to, you know, we can get into that, but I think, you know, I wanted to give you that full spectrum because I think there's a lot that what really mattered, I think, in this conversation, you know, in that trajectory was culture was a gargantuan piece that directed me. I think the ability that I had, that it was ethnic professionals that were teachers or right in from middle school to high school, all the way through college, right? It was people along the way that had that saw that I had an ability. I was not polished at all. I was not like one of those kids that knew what he was doing, but they just knew I had talent. Yeah, it was raw. And they were like, you know what? He has ambition and that's great, but he has some talent. And you know what? He has a good mindset. He's willing. He's going to hustle. Like he's going to work for it. And they put me into positions that allowed me to not only succeed, but they, you know, when I screwed things up, you know what I mean? They gave me that kind of that room, that runway to be able to fall and then get up and be able to learn from those mistakes. Yeah. And then it was in that mix when I was in the agency world and I had, so mind you, right back to the point of, right, like my career was going to falter. It was when I came out to Denver that it was in 06, 07, that I got recognized by AdColor and I met Tiffany, you know, Tiffany Warren and me and Tiff became just instantaneous. She was like my, I always call her my hermanita. You know what I mean? She's like my little sister that.
Right.
And we hit it off and AdColor is one of the greatest jewels of my career, of my entire path.
That's awesome. So, great stuff.
Yeah. So there's a lot in there and I'd rather really wanted to anchor in that, you know, I just think it's very timely and it's very much in line with what the discussions that you have on this podcast. I think the things that mattered was, you know, culture and this idea of people of color that saw somebody that had, you know, talent and said, you know what, I'm going to help that one.
Yeah.
And they reached back and they threw a lateral wall, man, to help me get over it.
So. Exactly. Yeah, man, I hear a lot of what you share. Yeah, for sure. And that is, I've had this conversation on more than one occasion, as you can imagine, you know, being the direction of the podcast here. You know, as I hear you talk, one of the things I hear is mentorship and, you know, having mentors. And it's one of the things that I really am committed to is making a difference with young people. And, you know, it's very reminiscent of conversations that I've had here on the podcast before, because, you know, I want to make a difference with young people. And I think they're obviously they're the future. And, you know, someone reaching down a hand to you and not judging you based upon your rawness, not judging you based upon the way you looked, not judging you even maybe based upon the way you act and where you come from and all those sorts of things that often get in the way of people being able to be fully expressed and really being able to see their own gifts and their talent. Somebody reached out to you and I hear mentorship. So one of the things I want to go back to is, you know, you were doing a lot, like this is manual, right? Calligraphy is a very manual art. When did the idea, you know, because we may be about the same age and, you know, we both have seen this digitization come across the world and everything became digital. When did the shift for you happen going from more of a, you know, manual kind of art with writing and things like that? How did it merge into becoming something digital? When did that take place for you?
Yeah, so it was wild, right? So back in, when I was in high school, right? Man, this is wild. And I got some crazy stories on this too. So the net of it, right? The core instance of the question was it happened right around the time, the cusp of when I was coming from high school into college. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason for that. Like industry wise, I saw that really take shape on, like from an industry standpoint, I really saw it when I was in college and I was right about to come out, right? Mm-hmm. However, it was right after that that I saw it become more on a commercial or consumer front. And there's a reason for that, right? So now we get into the interesting part of the story over how that happened, right? Because it happened in two channels, right? You think about it, right? So first channel in college, I knew it was coming because when I was in school, so I went to FIT and at FIT, I studied graphic design as a core major, but advertising design was my undergrad study, right? And in those courses, I had always gone to art school, right? I had mentioned I was in music and art and I was doing calligraphy. And just like you said, everything was manual, right? And all of my friends that I got a 3-decade brotherhood of all my graffiti writers in Brooklyn, like in Elric, point. They're going to go crazy about this conversation here, like Gumby and everybody, Exile, you know what I mean? Clear, everybody, Beast. Right. We were on, and they were all writers. They're my idols, right? They were my idols. They're people that I love and admire, you know, the creativity. I absorbed 1/10 of what they were able to just spit out. And I was just fortunate, right? But they have incredible talent and running with them, everything was, they opened my eyes to what creativity could be like. And for me, I got into letter forms. Well, when you study the graphic design at the time that I was going to school, there were still these things called type houses where, mm-hmm. you would actually go and you would create the posters that you would want, right? And literally, like, had whether it was a cover for a magazine, you know what I mean? Didn't matter what it would be. You would style it, you would design it, and send it to a type house. And all those type houses would create these films that they would then get back to you. And then you would actually overlay them, your photographs, and create the posters, right? So it was a rudimentary manual way of creating poster design. Right. Think of it that way, right? By the time I graduated in the 2.5-3 years, that I was going through college in that transition period, those type houses went from they supplied us with everything that we needed for our classes to becoming literally gone because computers got stepped in.
Wow.
So by the time I graduated, I bought back then an Apple Mac-centric computer that ran me Gs, yo. It ran me close to like over 5 Gs to buy. Wow. I had no idea what the hell I was buying. I had never used one. I took out loans on it. It took me like 9 years to pay that off. You know?
It's totally obsolete. By the time you play it off, it's totally obsolete, right? It's like,
yeah, man. It's like the inflation is nothing. Inflation was nothing compared to that. Like it was like it was like buying the equivalent of like buying like a Range Rover. You know what I mean?
Right,
like
right.
College, I was broke, right? I was surviving like on 50 cents. Like I had to figure out where I could get a bagel for $1, right? Every day.
Right.
Well, I had to buy this Mac Center. So I buy this computer and I had no idea how I was going to use it. We were not using computers in school yet. They were just becoming these computer labs that they were starting to outfit.
Yep.
But I knew I needed one because my type houses were going out of the way. And I was like, well, I'm going to have a career in this somewhere, somehow. I know that everything's going to go digital at some point. So I got to figure it out.
Right.
Graduate. Boom. So now I'm on the outside. Consumer side, I started working at, there were like a couple of little different computer shops that were around. Mm-hmm. And I knew digital, everything's going to go digital. And because I'm pretty well versed in how to be able to handle computers now, now that I own one, let me try to parlay that and get a job in one of these places, kind of like a Kinko's before they were with the Kinko's.
Right.
They used to be called Kinko's. Got a job there. And of course, on the side, I'm a hustler. So then I started hustling for like logo jobs. People were coming to give me their resumes. And I was like, hey, you know, you do this thing. Yeah, you know what? I also do logo design. I do this, all this other stuff. And boom. And next thing you know, I was picking up a lot of other jobs. Well, that, because I still have my connects on the street. So Clear is a, was a big, you know, big time DJ. He's got his own record label now. And he was running, you know, in New York. I mean, it's back in the day when all the street mixtapes were coming out.
Right.
Where they had became where the mixtape sort of like Design Kings. You know what I mean?
So yeah.
When Clear was dropping his things, he'd come to me, yo, let's go. We need to do a shoot. You know, he was like, yeah, you know, I want to do this thing, cut out this picture. I was like, ah, now we got to go, let's go shoot everybody. I still got the films today of us in Greenpoint.
Wow.
Back in the day from way back when. And I would translate all of that manual stuff. I was right in that cusp, right in between the transition. And that allowed me to be able to take a lot of the mastery that I had learned of manual process, but then be able to apply that right to digital, sort of like digital creation and distribution. Right. And so I was fluid in that. Like that to me, it was like, it was just like the way I'm bilingual, you know, bicultural and Latino markets and then in American sort of like cultural market.
Right.
Same thing. It was like digital and manual and digital and design and manual design. I was able to flow between those two worlds seamlessly. And
that's awesome, man.
That's how everything kind of took off. But it actually, the roots of all of that and where everything really got ingrained, it actually wasn't taught for me in school. It was actually making mixtape CD covers. And here's the twist of just the hilarity of this. When it, by the time when I got recruited to come out to, because my mom would see me in late at night, working on Clear's tapes and working on the CD covers and everything. So my mom, she was like, you know, a little Puerto Rican lady back in the day. And she was like, oh, you know, you do all these CD covers. Like, you know, what are you doing? So when I got recruited to go to Denver, to come here to Denver and run the agency side of the business, I showed her my offer letter. You know, I was like, look, Ma, like I did it. You know, I made the jump. You know what I mean? They were going to, my mom looked at the letter and I'll never forget this. And she was like, they're going to pay you that much money to make CD covers? It came that's full circle. Yes, that's
Exactly. CD cover. I'll send you a little something every couple of weeks, and just know that your son is making CD covers for a living.
Really good CD covers out of Denver.
Exactly, dude. That's dope. Hell of a story, man. Hell of a story. So I want to sort of transition over into, you know, what you're doing it briefly. And I mean, you know, I went on the website and just watched some of the videos and checking out what you're actually doing. So you and I both know that content is king, and it is going to be right now for the foreseeable future. Content will continue to be king, right? So when did you actually start briefly? And, you know, and I don't know if this is sort of goes in line with the answer you gave about seeing the digital revolution happening, but when did you see that content, because what you're doing with Briefly and content, making it actionable data, right, is a little bit different and it's kind of unique. So I really like that, because I work for companies, I consult with companies, and I know that having that data presented in a way that they can actually use it to develop action and strategy is so critical to the business, right? So when did you start to see the value of content, for one, and then the importance of being able to take that content or take whatever data you got, right, and aggregating that to make it actionable items for a company? When did you see that all taking place?
So it was really interesting, because there are periods that I think the way that we go through in ethnic culture, we have our own cultural sort of periods.
Right.
I think corporations go through the same thing.
Right.
And I think we went through one that was dynamic. So let me give you the setup. So just to level the playing field, right? So Briefly is really just a quick summary of that. Is essentially Briefly is an insights reporting platform where we allow, and it's endemic. It's really for niche audience in the corporate sector and the B2B side. And really what we did was we created a tool or a platform solution that's cloud-based that allows like market researchers and people who deal with like insights. See, most people don't realize that when you see a Super Bowl just happen, right? So this is a good example, right?
Right.
If before you create the commercial and before you create the ad, there's actually a wealth. There's a whole exercise for about a year, 18 months in advance of that commercial coming out. That research was conducted. And they went out and an agency went out and collected insights or collected data on a variety of different consumer targets, et cetera. So there's like the science before you get to the art. Well, all those researchers and all those insights professionals, they have to manually work with the data that they go out and they collect. And then the challenge that these companies have is they have to compile that information into some way, shape, or form. Typically, it winds up being like a presentation document, like a Canva, you know what I mean, or a PowerPoint file. And then they have to deploy that. They have to distribute that to all the different marketing teams. They have to keep these teams informed because the teams have to know, they have to have data in order to create the marketing that they want to be able to put out into the world, right? So you don't want to just create marketing that's not backed by data, right? Because then it's just, you're just creating.
Which could be, fun, just might not be very profitable, right?
Yeah, exactly, right? So you just blow on money, right? So these companies, they struggle with that. And because a lot of that process, right, is very manual. And example that I always give is that, and this is what we got recognized for. So the consultancy that I started, you know, back in 2012 that I had formalized, is we worked with a lot of companies, a lot of B2B companies. And one of them was like, and I give this classic example of like PepsiCo. PepsiCo was a great, you know, time. It was fantastic. I mean, we had, it was when the whole crew was there. You know what I mean? Frank was there. A bunch of us were there. And essentially we had the insights department, right? That at PepsiCo, they would come to us. They'd be like, hey, look, you guys are really good at being able to package up like data. You guys have a way of designing really interesting things out of like presentations out of a lot of the science that we have.
Right.
And they called us up one day and they were like, hey, look, I got like 400 pages of research that we went out and collected. So if you can imagine the amount of money that gets pumped into creating that kind of research is exponential. And they were like, hey, look, no, but nobody's reading it. I got 40 marketing teams from North America and I need them to have this information, but they're not going to read 400 pages.
Right.
Right. How do I get this? How do I get this over to them in a way that they can use it? And so we did that as a custom reporting solution on the consultancy side. And what we realized was that this was a common pattern that we had seen. So this is happening now from like 2012, you know, 2014, 2015, it's starting to really get, because data, right? If you think of what was happening in that time, mobility was rising, right? Mobile phones really came to prowess in 2010, 2011. And it started to exponentially rise. And so companies all of a sudden were struggling with not only teams being able to get access to their emails on phones, so mobility. But they were also struggling with a lot more data now coming into the house by coming into the company because big data started to catch on, right? Companies were starting to buy. You can amass more and more data. Cloud was becoming, was starting out. And then at the same time, the third piece that helped shift it all was that teams are getting younger. Employees, are skewing younger. They're not skewing older, which means that this is all, in all fairness, I love every millennial and Gen Z out there. I got an awful Gen Z in my household. Man, they don't, nobody wants to read, right? Nobody wants long form. They want three bullets. Give me what I need to know right now. So I can go chop chop and I can go, you know, man, go do what I got to do. Because I'm not going to read 20 pages. I'm not going to read 40, right? So why are you going to be 400? So a lot of that research was falling on deaf ears, right? Nobody was actually using it. So on the consultancy side, we helped package up a lot of that material and deploy that to their teams. And we did this with PepsiCo. We got featured on Digiday. That article's still up there. You know, how PepsiCo swings up insights. It's a consultancy that we have, Sticky Dots. And we did that for a number of different companies. We started working with them. We worked with Diageo. Diageo, a lot of people may not know, but they actually run, they're the largest liquor holding company in the world. One of the largest. So every major brand works with them. So same thing, right? They're a large company with a lot of sub brands and they do a lot of research and they need to be able to distribute and deploy. We did some of that work for them on their global teams, worked with Smirnoff. What we realized was as we kept doing this, we kept seeing the pattern. There was a pattern that was happening. And this is happening between 2015, 2017, really. And that's when the light bulb went off. And I was like, hey, wait a minute. We keep doing this on a one-to-one. You know what I mean? I mean, this is stuff even happening. We did it with Fox Latin America, you know, in Latin America, same thing. They're distributed teams all across Latin. They had one insights team. They had to keep people informed that they couldn't, people weren't going to read it. And I put pen to paper and was like, you know what? There's got to be a better method. And because cloud was rising and there you could, you know, platform solution was starting to rise, right? Startup ecosystems were starting to get built. And I was like, you know what? This may be an opportunity to build a product that we could take all the best practices that we've taken with all these other brands, bake that into some kind of product solution. We could actually take that to market. And sure enough, I put that down, a rough outline of what that was going to be, started tinkering around, spent a lot of money that I shouldn't have, you know, in developing some preliminary stuff, you know, right out of the gate.
Sure.
But we tooled around and kept trying to tinker at it. And then eventually I connected with a good buddy of mine, Toby, who started the Boomtown Accelerators up here in Boulder. And actually, I should mention before I got there, one piece that was instrumental for me to actually formalize what Briefly would be or what it would become actually happened out of the Numi Accelerator that happened right before I went to Boomtown. So Numi Accelerator was an accelerator started up by Angela Benton.
Okay.
And you know Angela, and if you don't know her, you got to look her up. But she is ICAR. She belongs on the Mount Rushmore of ethnic founding and startup in tech. She's the CEO of Streamlytics, but she ran the Numi Accelerator. That eventually sold that off, and but she's known and renowned in the tech sector because she was based out of and helped start up. If you look at Black America, the CNN special that they did, and they featured all things on tech entrepreneurship and people of color, Angela's on there. Like that's what I mean. She belongs to Mount Rushmore.
Heavy hitter. Yeah.
And she about it, man. And so I went down to Miami. She was like, look, you need to come down and just spend a week with us here. Come to the accelerator. And let's put it all down on paper. Let's see what we can do. And man, after, you know, a week with her, it was like, yeah, I know what Briefly can be. It helped solidify the vision. I give her a lot of credit for that.
Absolutely.
And then, eventually I went to Boomtown. My boy Toby was like, hey, look, you got a great idea. It's a great concept. We need to formalize it. Come to the accelerator and that'll help to, we can actually put it down and get you to an MVP product to be able to.
Yeah.
And Boomtown really helped us to put the deck chairs in the right order. Do you know what I mean? Like it really, a lot of ideas. We were all over the place. And being an ethnic founder, you don't have resources. You don't have people. I was lucky. I was lucky because I had Angela. Yeah, I went out and I looked for it, but I found Angela. And then now I was like, Angela, like that's it. Like I'm, ask Tiffany. Same thing with like Ag. It's like you ain't gonna lose me now. I'll be annoying. You know what I mean? I'll be around. I'm cousin. I'm primo now.
Right.
So now I'm just gonna roll up in the house. You know what I mean? I'm gonna roll up on a Saturday and just be like, I need help. You know what I mean? And so they were instrumental in helping guide my thinking. And Toby, same thing. I met Toby when I was taking my EUA classes. And it turned out that Toby happened to found this accelerator and was like, look, you could come here and figure this out. But I'll be honest with you, Boomtown really, they had a real structured format and educational process, like systematic. They had the right people, the right trainers. I mean, it's a robust, program that you go through. And that's where they're nationally renowned. And so going through that process was crucial because otherwise I don't think I would have been able to get out of that. And we got, the people that handle our, Curve 10, they're the guys that they're mentors of ours and they were advisors that we found through Boomtown. They handle all of our development. They do it all at cost for us and they've helped us, build Briefly into an MVP product. And so that happened in 2018. We graduated from the accelerator back in 2018.
Okay.
And then came out and then, a big thing for founders, what they tend to realize, especially in the SaaS sector is, a lot of these founders, they think the game is actually to get funded. And look, funding is a path to get there. But it is not the path. And I'm not going to dive into that much. And we can, again, I'm happy to explore wherever you want to go. But, but I do think that what's important to call out is that, we went the path of self-funding. We went the path of bootstrapping the startup.
Okay.
And a large part of that just had to do with time. Look, I'm old school like that. Like I build great products that I can do. I could design the best of them. You know what I mean? I don't write a line of code. I do not. I mean, it's barely enough that I could proof JSON when the engineers give, you know what I mean? Like, right, you know what right, I mean? Right. Like, you see that, but I knew what I, what I'm really good at is knowing what I don't know.
Right.
And making sure that I can go out and find the right partners to be able to help complement the things yes. that I lack.
Yes.
And that's, you have to be very astute to, you have to be, you gotta be humble to know that, to know where your line ends and how much I could learn. Now, I could learn anything to be deadly, but right. I cannot learn it fast enough to be a master when I know I got to move this fast.
Exactly.
And I chose to bootstrap, and I was fortunate to be able to do that. I had a consultancy. I had the ability and the means to be able to do that.
Right.
But I think it's important to just call that out, and we can dive into that if you want. But,
yeah.
but I, you know, again, that transition really happened briefly, became really formalized in 2018. And then since that time, we've been in bootstrapping it. And then the reason for that is because it allows us to be able to go out and do what the B2B sector, you, when you're figuring out product market fit, it could take, it's not like you find out on Monday and then Tuesday.
Right.
Like,
right.
Well, founders think like, oh yeah, when I launch, that's it. It's the thing. And then the investors are going to come.
Right.
No, man. Like I said in the show, launching is cute. You know, survive, make payroll, payroll 7, 8, month 9, month 10.
Yes.
And then it's sought. You know what I mean? And then, yeah. and then you got something. Then you could really say that you're a founder. Launching exactly. is not founder.
Exactly.
Right.
I mean, and it, so yeah, it, I it, totally it, agree. It, you know, I want to get into some of the challenges of, you know, being a founder of color, right? And, but I just listening to you talk, you know, one of the things I hear is that you're willing to be vulnerable. Like, you know, you got to know where, hey, this is not my area. You know, I mean, I can manage it to a certain degree, but I'm like, you know what? This is just not what I do, right? This is not, you know, your area, you know, your lane. And like, this is where I thrive. I can design the shit out of anything. Now, writing code ain't what I do. I could probably figure it out. But it's all it's going to do is prolong what I'm trying to do and prolong getting to market, right? And if we want to get to market in a reasonable time and begin to get some kind of an ROI, then we've got to know where our limits are. And I think that's huge for a founder and an executive to just be able to know, hey, this is not my area and I can spend a ton of time here and not get anywhere, right? So how do I create partnerships, strategic partnerships to help me get to where I want to go? How do I enroll a mentor, bro, like you did, right? And what conferences and what other platforms are available out there that I can see how I can scale this in a reasonable manner that's effective. So I love that you're willing to say, hey, you know what? This ain't my area. That guy right there, though, he kills it in this area. Let me go get him, right? Yeah. And work with that person. Man, it's really great. So Marcus, and you also talked about, you know, you bootstrapped it all. And we know that a lot of founders aren't able to do that. And fortunately, you were able to do that. Again, that might prolong some things because you got to manage cash flow, et cetera. But yeah. You're willing to do that, right? What would you recommend? Like, what other avenues might you have considered, or what other avenues have you seen other founders of color who might have, you know, limited access to gain funding to fund their projects? What other recommendations would you give them? Things that you've seen work for other founders?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think you hit it on the head. I think that, you know, in my case, it was specifically the ability because I had a consultancy,
right.
And I knew that in the initial phase of creating the product, like I knew that there's just a reality of, and again, experience teaches you this, right? So right. in helping having built other products, also, you know, you just gotta be savvy.
Right.
And this is the Brooklyn in me. Like I knew when we were doing the custom development stuff, I always knew that further on down the line, I was going to develop something.
Right.
So I used every project opportunity to answer the client need.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I did it always with the antenna up, mm-hmm. realizing and picking, all right, I need to keep that. And then right. I need to keep that because eventually I'm just going to combine all those things.
Right.
And so you have to, you're absolutely right by hitting it on the head about saying how much time it takes. Cause it's also bootstrapping is a way to save, but it's costly. And it costs yes. you time.
Yes.
And that's an important equation that you have to be cognizant of. You got to be conscious that, you know what? If I could take the time to try to learn it, but am I trying to learn it to be greater than and be a master at it, right? And control that area? Mm-hmm. Or do I need to learn enough so that I could be dangerous enough?
Right.
So that I could get out the door. And what I think the one thing that a lot of founders don't have is clarity. Because there's so much coming at you.
Yeah.
that they don't, you don't realize that your product is a marathon. They call it sprints because you need to do sprint runs to be able to get to the run, but
right.
You're not sprinting to funding. You're sprinting to build a company. It's right. Different.
Right.
And I think it's a marathon, and you don't realize that when you're a founder that your product is going to go through 100 iterations, and there's going to be 100. There are 100 levels that you just got to keep climbing.
Yeah.
And you don't realize, you just don't have that kind of wisdom to know that I just need to get to now and level 3. Mm. How do I break down out of the 100 levels that I got to get to? How can I just break down what I need to do to get from level 1 to level 3? Right. Because level 1 to level 3 may cost you $50. Right?
Right.
But all you're thinking about is level 100.
Right.
When, right? Many founders will think, well, what happens when I get funded? Well, you don't realize that when you get funded, you're giving up more than half of the equity of the company that you have. So you're going to work all of that way to get there. And then all of a sudden, you're going to have to give it all away. So you actually may want to prolong that as far as you want. Now, in my case, learning how to be able to make that transition and kind of figure out what I needed to do meant compartmentalize. I had to break down the things, understand that, you know what? Right now, I just need to have a landing page and I just need to be able to design that. I need to have a logo that's going to be on there. I need to have a couple images and I need to have a couple blurs of copy.
Right.
That's it. Because the only thing I'm trying to do is I'm trying to test whether or not someone will click on the button that I want them to click.
Right.
It literally is that. Right. The art of this is actually being able to break down a B2B cloud-based SaaS solution that people can subscribe to, right? Made for enterprise market researchers.
Right.
No, you're just trying to figure out, I got to do a landing page.
Right.
I got to be able to click on a button. And what do I need to tell them in order to be able to click on that button?
Yes.
That is literally what next month could be about.
Right.
And so founders, they get, you know what I mean? They get spun up because they think that they have to think through. Yeah, you got to think through, you know, level 100, but you don't have to solve for level 100.
Right.
You got to solve to level 3. And then they only cost you $50. So I think compartmentalization of what the problem is, and being able to break that down into something that's, right, usable and functional. And when you can do that, right, for level 1, and you can continue to do that, that helps you to assess and that helps you to be able to see, you know what, when I get to these levels, I'm going to need some money.
Yeah.
Right. So maybe what I need to do is, my case, it was like I knew that I had to park every new project that I was able to get. Sometimes I couldn't get additional freelancers to do some of that work and I had to do it.
Right.
Right. So that wasn't putting that money out of pocket. And I had that carved out a couple more. Or sometimes I just knew, I got to hustle up. If I could land an extra project or two, that's going to give me the funding that I need to pay for the engineers that are going to need to develop the code.
Exactly.
Right. Downside of not being a technical founder.
Exactly.
But I then split that cost with the engineer. So Kurt was like, if you're going to handle all the UIX build, like if you're going to design it all and you're going to handle all the testing, well, then we don't have to do any of that. You're just going to pay us for the development. Mm. I didn't know that. Well, all of a sudden, wait a minute. You know what I mean? So what would have been like a $5,000 expense on writing code, right, to build out this huge feature, now all of a sudden becomes like a $2,500 one. Why? Right. Because I'm designing all of the front end, right? And I'm supplying them all the pages. They don't have to figure any of that stuff out. And then we handle all the testing. So you can also barter, right? You can also share.
That's a good point.
Right? The areas of development that need to get done. You don't have to. It's not like King Kabuto. It's not like baby in bathwater for everything. You know what I mean? When you line up another potential. And that's the thing about being aware and having the humility to know, you know, like being a founder is not just about networking and knowing the investors and or only being a technical founder and then thinking that you're going to write all the code. I mean, yeah, that's great. But when you're building products, products are about user experiences. They're about, it's about storytelling.
Yeah.
It's about, right? Like it is so much more than the technical piece of what it is that you're delivering. And I think a lot of founders, they get caught up in holding the cup so tight. You know what I mean? That it has to say all these things. Man, you have no idea. Man, it's like, perfect example is like, we put this thing out. People are like, oh yeah, I thought briefly did this other thing. And I was like, but I explained to you on the page with the button what it does. How did you get that?
Right.
And you realize that there's a million definitions for the one thing that you can do. So anyway, so the point here is that I think founders that when you talked about the humility, the ability to being able to, you got to park your ego.
Yeah.
Right. Cause you want to park your ego. You want to get your, you want to have a humbling experience. Take whatever product that you're developing right now, put it in the market.
Right.
Right. Put it in front of your potential customers. And that's what we did. I took the MVP of what Briefly was going to be as a concept, and I put that in front of all of our current and past clients. And had to sit there and have them tell me like how shitty it was.
Right.
You know what I mean? How bad of an experience it was.
Right.
And that is what enabled me. That's where the humility came from. It was like, no, you got to build, you are at the service of who you're serving.
That's right.
Period.
Facts.
When you build products, it's serving leadership that way. Yeah. You're leading them down a path to where things are going to be better for them.
Yeah.
But you have to do it in such a way that you have to have humility. You can't just be, you know what I mean? Oh, no, like, I know where we need to go. You're going to be on an island by yourself.
Right.
Because nobody wants to work for somebody like that. Nobody wants to partner with anybody like that. And this is the one piece that culture, this is the downside, right? Of when you're an ethnic founder, you got a lot of like fight in you, man, because you're angry as hell. Right. Like, you're mad at the world, right?
Right.
But you ain't like, nobody's cutting you checks. Nobody's cutting you checks. Ain't nobody looking for us.
Right.
Like, you know how lonely it wrote this was? Like, we even talked about this on the show. Yo, it's lonely, man. And the more up you go, the less of people that you look like are going to be with you.
Yeah.
That's just a fact.
So true.
It's a fact. Okay. So when you get to that point, I think the cultural piece is incredibly important because you have not thought about it. You've been learning so much to become a founder that you join these new networks, you go to these new spots.
Right.
And then you think you got to be this hard. You're carrying all that angst with you into these rooms. And then you realize, oh, you know what? This, like, you're making the transition. Like, this is actually now happy time. And I know it can be very aggravating because a lot of people are not, but you actually have to have the humility. You have to have that sense of, you know what?
Yeah.
Like, I know myself. And that's where, you know what I mean? That authentic side of you really has to be able to come through. And I think a lot of times there's a lot of cultural biases that we bring into those rooms, right? And
totally.
I mentioned this on the show, you know, like debt, right? And what that involves.
Yeah.
Mental health, right? The stigma of Hispanic and Black men being able to talk about, you know, mental health. Like, well, I don't feel right. You know what I mean? Like, I don't feel like talking to people and it's been a couple of weeks. And you know what? Maybe I just don't feel right.
Yeah.
Who are you going to talk to about that? Right. Like, sometimes you can't even go to your own family because your family will look at you like, if you get in therapy, they're going to look at you like, oh, well, man, you know, maybe your mic is a little crazy right now. Like,
right. You're going to be all right, bro. So, you're going to be all right hanging there, dog. You're going to be all right.
Maybe I'm not. You know, like, okay, you know,
right.
But I think on the other side, what I can tell you, like I went through, you know, before my first ball was here, and I don't want to go too much off on a tangent, but I think I do think that they're just important pieces. And I think you hit it on the head. It has to do with humility, but the humility comes from, you have to be centered.
Yeah.
Right. And you don't want to get in this game and do this, man, because it's, you need, your soul has to be filled.
Yeah.
Your soul has to be filled. You have to have, you're doing this. It's not for money, man.
Right.
Not money.
Yeah.
That's, you got to do this. You're building wealth. And if you're trying to build wealth, right, that's generational. That's not 100%. About pay. That's not about making payroll. You can do that and go get a FedEx job or work for Amazon.
Right.
You know what I mean? You want to get money. There are faster ways to do it, easier ways to do it.
Right.
This is different. And I think the humility component is core. And at the same time, I think a large part of that comes by way of, you got to find your authentic self and you need your soul to be full.
Yeah.
And without that, you'd be an empty shell, man, just, you know, building product. And people will know that.
Exactly.
Partners will know, my employees will know that. And so I just think it's important to call that. Yeah,
totally agree with you, bro. Couldn't disagree at all, even if I wanted to. So let's talk about real quick the opportunity that came to be a part of the Founding in Color series on NBC Peacock. How did that opportunity come about, and what has it meant for you as a founder of color to be a part of that and the message that you're able to get out to the masses?
Yeah. So it was really interesting because actually I had found out when they were, I think they were shooting or casting for season one. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to remember, I believe it was Boomtown. Because they work with Comcast Labs.
Okay.
And it was the beauty of going through an accelerator, right? You're part of the alumni network. And I remember there was a leap that went around about, so like Jose, who's one of the guys that they was like, yeah, you know, they got this thing about Fontaine and Cullen. He's like, you should just check it out. And I went to Fontaine and Cullen and saw some of the season one. They were, I think they were casting for the Sun.
Okay.
And they had put out a call and they were like, hey, look, fill out this online sort of like survey. And I was like, oh, this would be great. Like, I'd love to just hear more about it and send some stuff in. And then forgot about it, right? And then they did season one. I think I saw one of the episodes. Can't remember which one it was, but I saw one of the episodes. But it wasn't as, you know, just sort of out there as much. It was harder to find. It was really niche, I think, when they, you know, when they first did it. And then, so it was like a year goes by, or like eight, I don't know how long it was that went by. But then last summer, I got a call from Akima. She was like, yo, she's like, yeah, look, You submitted your stuff to Fontaine and Cullen, and I'm one of the producers on the show that's helping out how the group do this. And I was like, and I was like, Akima, I was like, I'm not sure if I remember. and then it was starting, you know what I mean? Like, you started having all the pictures in your head.
Right.
I remember now. She's like, well, when you submit your stuff for season one, but she's like, but your stuff's great. She's like, I'd love to talk to you about, would you be willing to cast for season two? And I was like, absolutely, for sure. I'm like, if anything I can do to help tell the story and kind of grow, whatever it takes. Last summer, they lined up a couple calls, met, you know, Bree. And when Bree came on, and this story, the lesson is about the power of the network, because you never know where you're going to go, right? You never know where it leads you.
Absolutely.
So Bree was one of the exec producers from Revolt, from the agency side of Revolt TV. And they were producing the job. They took over the production.
Okay.
And they were like, hey, look, we'd love to talk to you. And in that casting call, we started talking. She goes, yeah, you know, I'm going to have our creative director, Andre Woolery, on. And I was like, wait a minute. I was like, is that Dre? And she was like, you know Dre? I was like, I wore a Dre with that color. Like, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. We're in the same book.
Right.
Literally the same. I got the book somewhere on here. And we're in the same taglines, but we got featured in the same book as the inaugural classes. You know what I mean? That came out of ACCO. We wrote this huge coffee table book. And Andre is something that I was always a fan of, because he's just a phenomenal creator.
Yeah.
For his generation, just phenomenal dude. And I was like, you gotta be kidding me. And she was like, and she goes, yeah. She's like, and you also know somebody that I work with. And I was just like, and then I put two and two together. It's a good friend of mine, Lindsay. Lindsay Reebling, she heads up Insights there. Lindsay helped give us a lot. She was one of the people that we actually put the MVP of briefing in front of to help us, you know, learn what we can do to get customer feedback. Like, how do we build a better product? And Lindsay graciously was able to give us some great feedback on the build out. And, you know, the world all of a sudden went from, you know, like very far and distant, you know, Akima saying, hey, yeah, would you submit your stuff, to all of a sudden becoming like literally within not 6 degrees, but like within 2 or 3 degrees.
Wow.
You know, like the world got really small, real
exactly.
fast.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that was last summer. I was, you know, heading up. I was one of the founding co-chairs here at Denver Startup Week. And they called me up and they were like, hey, look, you know, I was volunteering some time. They called me up, like, look, we want to put you on a cast and have you with one of the groups. And that's when I met Ofo, and one of the most beautiful souls I think I ever met on this planet in my lifetime. Ofo's, you got to have, I mean, he's just a phenomenal human being.
Yeah.
Laurel and you know, Chantel. I mean, it's just the founders that they paired us with, and we vibed. They put us on a call and we had two calls with each other, and we just vibed. We had everybody just, you know, was about it, and they all have amazing stories. I'm fans of theirs, you know what I mean? And I just feel fortunate enough to be able to share that stage with them.
Yeah, for sure.
And then that's how it all came together. And then we got cast and then shot last fall.
That's awesome, man.
But we had to keep it on the wraps. I mean, we couldn't say anything until.
I know. Yeah, I watched several of the clips. We got an early sneak peek into some of the clips. And what you're pointing to is very evident in the clips that I watched. There is a certain synergy between you all on the set. Like, you can tell that conversations have been had, very rich conversations that have been had already off camera. And that is felt in every segment on camera. You can see that there's a connection there. There's a mutual admiration amongst each founder in that segment. So I really see that. So what does it mean for you, you know, not only being chosen, but for representing Puerto Rican Americans? You know, you represent African Americans, you're representing all, you know, my wife's Filipino, you know, all the colors. you know, the color of the spectrum that, you know, that people that would be considered people of color. What does it mean for you to represent that group?
Personally, it was, you know, when I walked in, I think one of the most profound things was when I walked in to do the shoot. First of all, this is why I love Dre and what they did with Revolt, and I commend them. Mm-hmm. You know, they went out and partnered with your production company with Basewood, and you walked in and the entire crew was ethnic.
Wow.
You know what I mean? It's rarely you ever go on a, I've shot content for over 20 years and advertising. It is a pain in the ass to try to fill out your entire crew. And I tried. Wow. You know what I mean? Every time I shoot in LA, in Miami or New York, doesn't matter where, I always try to fill it out with as many people of color as I can.
Yeah.
And they just did it. They like nailed it with incredible talent. You know what I mean? Of shooting the show. So I think you walk in and you realize like you and one's cousins.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
For sure.
Then all of a sudden the profoundness is different. It's like what I would tell people when I was on the board with Akon, we were building out the conference. I would tell the same thing to the award winners. I'm like, listen, when you go up there to talk, you got to get tight. Cause it's like, I don't think you understand what the people that you're going to be talking to. And these are like global creative directors. And they're like, nah, man, like, you know, like I've done this before. This is not. And then they get up there and I'm like, no, I don't think you understand. It's like you're in a room with all new cousins. And now you got to talk to that.
Yeah.
That's not talking to the industry. You're not talking to the industry. You talk industry, there ain't nobody going to feel you.
Right.
And they got up there and I literally have had people come off and cry. Cause they're like, yo, you like, that's such a different. And that's for me, that's the world coming around to bite you in the ass. Cause then when I rolled up on set, you start realizing that when you're telling these stories, you're just like, oh man. Cause for the whole time, you got to understand when you're a founder and you're an ethnic founder, you're by yourself. Mm-hmm. You're alone.
Yeah.
Right. And as a founder, it's not like you're going to go to your employees and be able to have conversations about certain things. You just can't, you just have to keep that. You got to keep that above board. And, so when you're in that room, it was profound for me, I think, of being able to, and it's one thing to have lived the story. It's another thing to actually say it, right? To say it and put it in the universe in that way, in that context. And sure enough, especially when you're, you know, I mentioned this on the show, like I'm of my generation and my family, I've come the furthest, right? Mm. And so no one has come this far.
Right.
And so you are really venturing alone, but you realize I've had decades of putting culture on my back and carrying it forward and doing whatever I can.
Yeah.
Right. From mixtapes and legitimizing mixtapes on the street corner, right? To building million-dollar campaigns for brands, right? That represented Latinos in the way that was rich in context and that was true to us, that was authentic to us.
Yeah.
I've done that, right? Did it for decades. And I felt like being able to go in that room, the humility that you have to have of being able to have that space.
Yeah.
I commend the production company for giving us the safe space to create it, to allow us to be vulnerable in that way and have these kind of conversations that you cannot have every day. And I think that was profound. So there was a sense of honor that I think I had to, that I wanted to be truthful to the story. And that's the reason why. I mean, a lot of times, you know, look, and this is the thing about being a founder, especially in startup culture. Like, I have issues with it because I think it got gamified, right? And for as much as I know a couple of people that went on like Shark Tank and they do.
Right.
The startup life has become more of a lifestyle than it is about.
I'd agree with that.
Right. Than it is about the work.
Right.
And it became more about that shiny penny moment. And it's, if you think about it, it's like, you know, it's glorified. It's glorified, you know, blood sport.
It is.
You know, investors. And if you think about it, I mean, we can get real deep. Like we went down behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Like of how just even in investment groups, you know what I mean? It's very much like Gladiator Night. It's like there's 12, yo, go to a pitch competition. There's 12 of you. Here's some swords and sticks and beat yourselves to stand. Whoever bludgeons you and the last one standing that we like, that's who we're going to fund. And then if you think about it, that's just, it's a little counterintuitive, but it's become gamified.
Yeah.
And it's become more of a lifestyle.
Yep.
You know what I mean? People trying to make fast money. And I'm not about that life. You know what I mean? I'm about that. I'm about that real. Like I build products. You know what I mean? I build it. And, and I find amazing talent, right? To try to work with. And I try to find people better than I am, than I am. And all I try to do is try to give them runway And I look at my job as being a way to be able to give them the room to be able to fail and to succeed and be, and to reach their apex. Cause if they're there, then I can just ride them along. You know what I mean? And make our way up. So I think there's a lot that gets baked in, but the honor that I felt that to have to carry that into the room and be truthful.
Yeah.
To my legacy, my family's legacy, my culture's legacy was important. And the winning piece of all of that, and I think the piece that I think felt incredibly rewarding was, you know, afterwards, Jason came over to me. He's somebody that has written for a lot of, you know, he's one of the key journalists in hip hop culture. Came over to me. He's Puerto Rican. Mm-hmm. There's a feeling. He was like, yeah, I just really want to thank you for like not letting us get lost, that there is a Boricua that's up there and that's actually trying to do this. And the fact that you told your story, and it was, to me, that was the way of the universe kind of rewarding me of being able to say, hey, look, you know, you did the right thing. And so, but humility and honor, I think those are the two things that go hand in hand. That's what I remember most.
That's dope, man. I mean, you know, and you mentioned something a second ago, you know, that, and this is how I see leadership, like being a leader. In fact, with Zyra, the interview I did with the immigration attorney, you know, that's what we talked about. We talked about what it means to be a leader, and being a leader is being a space for other people to really thrive and for help them fly. Like, you don't have to do everything, right? You create the space so that everyone else around you is free to just be in action. And all of a sudden you look down the road, 3-6 months down the road, you're like, damn, we did all this. Wow. Yeah. Because you just created the space for them to just be whatever they want to be, whatever you want to do, right? I'm here to guide you. I'm here to consult with whatever you need. But at the end of the day, I want you to go out and do what I hired you to do. And that's to be great. And I know you already can do it because I've seen your work. You bring a body of work with you. So I know you can do the work, right? So I love that, man. One last question, Marcus, I want to ask you. On the Everything Matters podcast, I always try to highlight like the future, right? And you already mentioned legacy. You know, you have kids that you're raising, you know, and one of the things, I work in the tech space as well as an effectiveness coach. And they're more now, I think, than they were 5-10 years ago, for sure. But I don't see a lot of minorities in the SaaS space. So what would you say to some young person who may be in college or maybe even in high school, middle school, and is enchanted with technology, you know, may want to pursue a career? What kind of advice would you give to someone who's looking to maybe make that something for themselves, maybe even be a founder one day? What would you say to them?
I think number one, right out of the gate, is I think there's been so much of an emphasis of STEM. Mm-hmm. And I learned this with my own son.
Yep.
And he's phenomenal. He's a fantastic, he can do the math. He actually has already got there. He's only in seventh grade now and completed Python level 2.
Awesome.
But he's not an engineer, man. He's not a coder.
Yeah.
You know, and I think what's important for young people, especially, is to know that to get into the tech sector doesn't mean that you have to write code.
So true.
I don't write a line of code.
So true.
But I built, right, a multi-million dollar business to be able to do work that has done profound work in the space. And I made my dent in the world without ever having, right, to do one line of code.
Yeah.
And so there are ways of you being able to do it without you having it. Like, there's not just one road. I think, and if there's anything that I do moving into the future, it's really to help broaden what the appeal of the tech sector can be. Cause I think there's so much that's needed.
Yeah.
Everything from the design of the front end, right, which has nothing really to do with technical ability. Mm-hmm. It just has to do with everything that has to do with it. So like, if you design and you love to be able to, if you love to organize things, if you're like into, you know what I mean? Like, color coding, and right, if you can curate content, there's a place for you in a B2B SaaS company because there's so many different disciplines that are needed to be able to bring a product to market and to find success with that product.
Indeed.
But it's not just the engineer. It's not just the math. You know what I mean? Yeah. Running code. And so I'd love the idea and the opportunity to be able to kind of broaden that definition of what it means to be someone who's ethnic, because there's a lot of talent that's out there in the ethnic community. Like, we hands down are the creators of culture, right? Wow. We lead where culture goes.
Facts.
And that stems from everything to fashion, to art, right? To design. And you don't have to be a technical person if you wanted to bring that discipline to a sector that really needs it.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's something that for me, it's about being able to broaden that definition.
Yeah.
And not leaving out people that would want to be in technology, right? But they just feel like, oh, you know what? But I don't write code, or I don't want to be an engineer. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be, right? You can still be in that industry and still be in that space, offering and bringing your best self and bringing talent to that space and bringing value to it. And you can still do that, right? Without ever having to sit in the engineer seat, right? You could still support it. You can lead it, right? Because engineering alone doesn't market products.
Right? Not true.
Engineering alone doesn't design the product.
Right.
Right. There's a lot in there. And so I think if you're, you know, you're a curator of you're a creator of content and you shoot great video, they need stories on it. There's a way to bring that with you too. So I think awesome, that's a really important piece.
Yeah.
I did want to mention, mentioned it. What's my that? Wife's also Filipino. That's what I knew. I like. See, doesn't have anything.
Right. That's awesome, man. We need to catch up offline. Yeah. We need to catch up offline.
Yeah, exactly, man. I always tell when people ask me about my sons, I'm like, yeah, they're Bruno Mars. Right. I just have Bruno
Pretty
Mars.
Pretty much. You have Bruno Mars kids. Exactly. That's dope, man. Exactly. That's dope. Man, Marcus, this has been a great conversation. It's, you know, I think we could go for another hour if we had the time. Is there any, I want to give people an opportunity to follow you and follow what Briefly's doing, in the B2B sector, you know, in utilizing data and what you're doing to give actionable insights to businesses. How can people follow you on social media if they want to follow you personally or follow the company? Where can they find you on social media?
Oh, absolutely. So on Instagram, you'll find us. We tend to gravitate a lot more towards Instagram, but if you want to find us anything on Briefly, you can go to LinkedIn.
Okay.
We're on LinkedIn, so Briefly app, so Briefly app, and you'll find us on LinkedIn. You'll find me on LinkedIn under Marcus Minnett, and so that'll be easy to find me there. Please do feel free to contact me. I don't have anybody handling my socials. I do it all. Awesome. So I do all of that social engagement. So if you do reach out, reach me through there. We're on IG as well, so you can catch me on the gram, under Marcus Minnett. If you see a lot of shoes in there, it's because you mentioned it. Yeah, I am a shoe designer as well. So yes, you'll find me on the social Mario. That's a spring line coming out. So I got to get ready for that.
Wow.
Yeah, man, I'm just trying to stay busy. But yes, you can find us on, if you look for the site itself, briefly.io. So Briefly again, .io. That's our marketing site that'll give you a really good context and background. And again, if you can use that as a default, need to reach me, just fill out any of the forms there. They all come into my inbox. So I'll be able to hit you up there.
Outstanding. Marcus, man, it's been a great conversation with you, brother. All the best to you, man, going forward, and excited to watch the entire series of Founding in Color, man, on NBC Peacock. If you want to continue to hear Marcus's story on a deeper level and some of the other founders in color that are going to be on this series, tune in to the next episode. When's the first episode? I know we're doing a panel on the 23rd. Me and the other podcasters talking about the series. When is it actually launching? Marcus, is it actually live now?
Yeah. So the episodes, they all dropped on February 16th. So last Thursday.
Okay.
So if you have Peacock, you know, hey, look, man, just don't buy a cup of coffee one day each month. Pick up Peacock for the next 3 months, you know, give them some due.
There you go.
Just spare yourself a cup of coffee and just be able to do it. Just when it supported, I applaud what Comcast, Lyft Labs, Isaac was able to do. I think they're a phenomenal team over there with Jeanette. I mean, applause to them because they saw the opportunity, they saw the need to have voices like this.
Yes.
And without them, none of this would have happened. Salute to Revolt and the whole crew over at Basewood and the production companies that were handling this and being able to put it together. They really lent us their line, their talents to be able to do it. So incredibly gratitude to them. So the episodes dropped on the 16th. Take a look at it. It's beautifully done, beautifully produced. All the episodes dropped. You can actually catch seasons 1 and 2. They're all available now in streaming. So there is no more time. Everybody kept asking me, what time are you show? I was like, it's stream.
Drop it, man. Go watch it.
Catch it whenever you walk. Catch it at 2 a.m.
Exactly.
You're on a train right now, go watch it.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like,
tap in.
But it's fun, fantastic stories. There's something, look, I think the one thing I'd love for viewers to read and listeners to be able to kind of get from this is that the shows are not just about us. They really are, especially, I think, important for if you're thinking about launching a business or if you are a founder or you work with one, it's an immense resource for you. The one thing I took away from watching these episodes is that you can use them now right to learn. But in the future, if you are thinking about launching a company and then you do later on, 6 months from now, there's something in this series for you to go back and listen to, and listen to the struggles of what people, to keep you aware of what's coming down the road for you. Like, that's the one thing I really applaud them in doing, is that they made it into a resource for you. That's not just you watch it one time and then it goes away. You can come back to this time and time again to be like, how did that founder deal with this problem?
Yeah.
Right. That I feel like I might be dealing with.
Yeah.
And there's a research, there's someone's got a story in those three episodes that can tell you that, that can help inform you. So
it's kind of like a map. They've laid out a map for you. Some of the pitfalls you might come across here. That's great, man. For founders who are coming behind you all.
Yeah, man. Great resource.
Great. Well, Marcus,
hey,
man,
thank you, man. Thank you for hosting me, man. I really appreciated this time.
My pleasure, brother. My pleasure, man. Anytime. Welcome back. I want to get you to come back maybe next year sometime and share more about how the app's coming along and what you guys are up to, man. And what else? What, you know, how the shoe line's coming along, man. I got to check out the shoe line. I might want to pick me up a pair. You know
Man. That might be a thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It might be a thing.
I love it, man. Well, hey, I acknowledge you, man, for everything you're doing, for standing in the space. For other founders in color, man, who are you know, wanting to create something for themselves, for their legacy, for their lives, for their families, man. And I thank you for really just, again, for standing there, man, and being committed, being humble, being vulnerable, and just letting people really feast off of the knowledge and experience and expertise that you bring to the table in your 20 plus years of experience in this space, man. So thank you.
I appreciate you. Thank you, brother. Thank you, man.
My pleasure, man. We'll talk to you soon. Stay cool. Stay warm out there in Colorado, man. Stay warm.
I'm trying, yo. Yeah, the color. My color's gone, man. I'm going back to the beach.
Well, have fun, my man. Take care of yourself, brother. Talk to you soon.
We're going, man.
You too.
Let's go.
This is Doris Brown's baby boy. We out.